Welcome once again to our series of Keep Holy the Lord's Day, and the Lord's Day will keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. My guest is Ron Eldred, who is professor of religion at John Paul II Catholic High and also professor of world history. We've been talking about the sacrifice of the Mass, the Old Testament sacrifices, the New Testament sacrifice of the Mass. We've been talking about what makes a sacrifice, this unique biblical concept of gift-giving to God, both in the Old and the New Testament. So we've gotten to the point where we're really now at the heart of the sacrifice of the New Testament, the New Covenant, which we call the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, or popularly the Mass. So Ron, let's talk about the sacrifice of the Mass a little much more in detail than we have. When did Jesus institute what we call the sacrifice of the Mass that takes place every Saturday night or Sunday morning when we keep holy the Lord's Day?
The Catholic Church has always taught that Jesus instituted the Eucharist, or the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, at the Last Supper. The Last Supper is the new and everlasting covenant sealed by the blood of the Lamb, Jesus Christ. It was the first Mass. The Catechism states that, quote, "By celebrating the Last Supper with his apostles in the course of the Passover meal, Jesus gave the Jewish Passover its definitive meaning. Jesus passing over to his Father by his death and resurrection. The new Passover is anticipated in the Supper and celebrated in the Eucharist, which fulfills the Jewish Passover and anticipates the final Passover of the Church in the glory of the kingdom," end of quote. Christ purposely waited until the Passover before he allowed himself to be arrested and killed. In fact, he hid at times. He stayed away. In fact, at one time, when things started heating up about 5 or 6 months prior to his passion, he left Judea with his apostles and went across the Jordan River to Perea and stayed there for several months. That was the area where John the Baptist had primarily done his baptizing, and he had a lot of followers over in that area. So Jesus was able to regain a lot of the followers he had lost in Galilee earlier after his Bread of Life sermon, which we're going to get here to in just a little bit. So Jesus purposely didn't allow himself to be arrested until the time of Passover, so that because his intention was to take the place of the Passover lamb. In fact, coincidentally, the very hour that he was hanging on the cross, between noon and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the priest in the temple started sacrificing the Passover lambs in the temple right at that very during that period of time.
Okay, so actually, the more we know about the Old Testament sacrifices, the more we can understand how Jesus fulfilled this prefigurement or this preview of what his sacrifice was going to be on the altar of the cross of Calvary. And that was previewed. Calvary was really previewed at the Last Supper.
You simply can't understand the New Testament, or the New Covenant, without understanding the Old Covenant, the Old Testament.
And I always like that reference you made, that the Last Supper was the first Mass. It's easy to connect last and first there. So let's go. What precisely do we as Catholics believe happens at Mass?
I had to repeat just a little bit some things we said earlier, as the Mass is a sacrament and a sacrifice. It's a sacrament because it imparts the grace of God, and it's a sacrifice because it makes present the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. And as we stated in our last session, a sacrifice is giving something precious back to God in adoration, thanksgiving, contrition, reparation, or petition. For a sacrifice to occur, there must be a present, as we've said, a priest to offer the sacrifice, a victim in which to offer, and an altar on which to offer it. Priest of the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, the high priest, is Jesus, who offers himself as the victim on the altar of Calvary.
Okay, St. Matthew, I think, has something to say about this.
Yes, let me quote from St. Matthew. This would be from, I thought I had it here. I don't have the...
Matthew 26, 26?
I do have it here. Matthew 26, chapter 26, 26 through 29. Also, Luke has a very similar, Luke 22, 19, 20. And so does Mark in the 14th chapter, 22 through 25. Very similar wording here at the consecration. But St. Matthew describes the event as follows. Quote, "Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them saying, 'Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins.'" Added to this latter part of the statement are the words, quote, "the blood of the new and everlasting covenant," end of quote, which makes reference, of course, to the New Testament, or the new and everlasting covenant, as we call it in the holy sacrifice of the Mass. The new covenant fulfills the old covenant. The old covenant that God had made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and David. And in this new covenant, it's the old covenant, the old sacrifices had to be sealed by the blood of animals. And so Christ takes the place of the Passover lamb, and so the new and everlasting covenant is sealed by the blood of Christ himself.
Okay, so we're really talking about something that's a mystery, but it's the fulfillment of the old covenant, the Old Testament, the old agreements God made with his people all through the Old Testament, and sacrifice was offered in preparation for the coming of the real Paschal Lamb, Jesus, who sheds his blood in the New Covenant or the New Testament. So why is it so important that as Catholics we understand particularly what's happening at the consecration?
Well, during the consecration of Mass, or the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, or the Eucharist, the priest representing the person of Christ, we're talking about now the ordained priest, he's representing Christ in persona Christi, that is, in the person of Christ. He says the words, quote, "This is my body," end of quote, "This is the cup of my blood," that's the second quote. And at the words of consecration, the bread and wine are transformed into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. He's made present on the altar in his full humanity and divinity. The Church calls this transformation, at least since the time of St. Thomas Aquinas, transubstantiation. Earlier in our series, we spent at least one session discussing the meaning of some other false views that Father Hardin had discussed, transfinalization and transignification. But the Church's view, the transubstantiation is, means that the substances of bread and wine really become the substances of Jesus' body and blood. Even though the accidents appear to be bread and wine, it still looks like bread and wine, in other words. And by accidents, we mean that the body and blood still look like, smells like, feels like, tastes like bread and wine, but truly is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, which fulfills the promise that Jesus made in his Bread of Life sermon in John 6.
And we're going to talk about John 6
yes.
just a little bit later. Okay, so you're saying words that the Church teaches, Ron, that are so profound that it's hard to talk about them in ordinary words. And it's one of the reasons that the Church in the liturgy has the priest, after the consecration, say, "Let us proclaim the mystery of faith." This is something far, far beyond anything we could possibly come up with or think about if Jesus hadn't talked about it at the Last Supper so clearly and previewed it in John 6. But I think part of the problem is that for us as Catholics that were raised with this, and it's in our catechisms, and it's so profound a truth that it's staggering. And when people who come into the church suddenly realize that that's what the church has always taught for 2,000 years, the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, it almost blows them away. And unfortunately, it should blow us away too.
Sure.
But I think here's a kind of familiarity breeds contempt. So I think it's one of the reasons we're talking about this. So we try to, I think Pope John Paul II wrote that Eucharistic mystery, encyclical on the Eucharist, to say that we could recover our sense of awe and reverence for this great mystery that Jesus gave to us at the Last Supper. Well, you want to go on maybe a little bit about the consecration of the bread and wine?
Yes, the separate consecration, or sometimes it's called the double consecration. And there's a reason for that. I mean, and I suppose they both could have been consecrated at the same time. But the church is, does that, what's called the separate or the double consecration, because it symbolizes the death of Jesus on the cross. That is the separation of his body from his blood.
Of course, and that's the way Jesus did it at the Last Supper.
But what really is happening at that time of the double consecration, Calvary is made present. In other words, an event that happened 2,000 years ago is somehow mysteriously made present on our altar, so that we can participate in the event that brought about our salvation. In other words, we are literally standing at the foot of the cross at that time, with our Blessed Mother and with Mary Magdalene and John, the beloved disciple, and Susanna and Joanna and the other women that were there. And not only that, but also present are all the holy saints and angels in heaven at every Mass, and the congregation, of course. And in a sense, the whole church is present at every Mass. I remember one time one of the Masses you were celebrating, and you made some kind of comment at an appropriate time, something about all the angels and saints, you know, are all present here in the whole church. You can't see these things, but they're there. They're nonetheless real, and there have been some saints that have been blessed with being able to see some of these things. Like I've told my students, it would be nice, it'd be easy probably to become recollected, which we're going to get to this a little bit later, and focused, you know, on the Mass, and stay focused on the Mass, that if the minute we walked in and we fell to our knees and all these things become visible to us, you know.
Legions of angels.
Yeah, legions of angels.
Standing around.
Yeah, and,
in the
and
side
all the saints and everything there, you know, and the whole church and all those wonderful things, the nine choirs of angels, whatever the choir. You know, that should keep our attention, but unfortunately we believe these things to be true because we accept that these things, that they are true on the word of another. And so we have to work at it.
Of revealed scripture.
Yeah.
And of course Jesus did say, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. At least we know there's a great reward for faith that we can't see as Thomas saw. I just like to throw in here, when I was in the first grade, I remember Sister Marion, who was a Franciscan sister, taught all the children, including myself in the class. Now, when the priest raises the sacred host at Mass, you're supposed to say quietly the words of St. Thomas, the Apostle, my Lord and my God. Well, the reason I throw that in is because what we learn early in life stays with us for the rest of our lives. And that's why religious education is so terribly important. The sooner we learn the awesome truths of the faith, the more they tend to sink into us and become part of us. I still do that when the host is raised, if I'm at Mass somewhere, not offering Mass. Okay, well, Let's go back. Sorry to get us off here. You were talking about the catechism says something about the sacrificial aspect of the Mass.
Yes, let me quote from the catechism in that regard. Quote, because it is the memorial of Christ's Passover, the Eucharist is also a sacrifice. In other words, the Mass is more than just a memorial. Protestants tend to look at the Last Supper and ceremony
they
have.
In memory
yes,
of me.
It's more of a memorial kind of thing.
And it is a memorial.
It is a memorial, that's true. But we Catholics carry it further, and we believe that, you know, that it's also a sacrifice. It really is made present there.
Right.
It doesn't happen, you know, over and over again. It happened one time, and that one time is made present. I've heard Protestants make comments to the effect, well, you Catholics believe that every time you go to Mass, Jesus dies. Well, this isn't true. He died once, and that one time is made present for so we can be there.
Just like, as you mentioned, Mary was at the cross, or the apostles were at the Last Supper.
Let me continue quoting here. The sacrificial character of the Eucharist is manifested in the very words of institution. This is my body, which is given up for you. This cup, which is poured out for you in the new covenant in my blood. In the Eucharist, Christ gives us his very body, which he gave up for us on the cross. The very blood, which he poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. In other words, the Last Supper, this is going to my, you know, to the quote there. The Last Supper and Calvary then are made present during the celebration, literally made present. And it's important to stress, though, that, as I said a while ago, that Jesus doesn't die every time. It's just simply that one time, sort of like a magic, not magic, I don't want to use that word, but mysteriously it's put in a time machine and kind of brought forth and put on our altar. I use those kind of examples to kids because they can relate to that.
Helpful.
So we can actually participate in that saving event.
So can we say that the apostles did not have an opportunity that we don't have by being there at the Last Supper? Of course, they got to see Jesus, but that we have the same opportunity to be at the Last Supper as it's re-presented once again on the table at Holy Mass on a Saturday night or Sunday when we keep Holy the Lord's Day.
I've heard people say, and I'm sure you have too, that, oh, I wish I could have been there and walked in the footsteps of Christ, been with him and his disciples, seen them. Well, we can, just as intimately as the apostles could, ever much so. And in fact, in a lot of ways, more so, because we can receive the body and blood of Christ, something they, of course, were not able to do until the Last Supper. When we had our sessions on the Nicene Creed, on one of those sessions, we discussed about 10 or 12 different ways that Christ still is present in his church. And as we pointed out at that time, the most unique way of being present, of course, is in the holy sacrifice of the Mass and in the real presence in the Blessed Sacrament, which is, of course, kept in the tabernacle, which the tabernacle literally means tent. It's a Hebrew word, if I recall right, for tent. And so the tent is the place where the tabernacle is the place where God pitches his tent amongst us, as he had, of course, the Israelites in the wilderness for 40 years in what was called the tabernacle, this special church, this special building that was designed in accordance with God's instructions that you find in the Exodus.
Okay. Well, could we kind of go, move on from what Vatican Council has told us about the Eucharist or the Mass or the reenactment of the representation of the Last Supper as being the source and summit of our Christian life? Those are pretty powerful words. The source of the Mississippi, you wouldn't have the Mississippi without its source, and the summit of Mount Everest is the highest point you can go. So why did the Vatican Council talk about?
Well, to use the exact words of the catechism says, quote, the Eucharist is the source and summit of the Christian life, which was rephrasing what had been said during the Vatican Council. It's a source because all of the sacraments, ecclesiastical ministries, and works of the apostolate are tied to the Eucharist and oriented toward it. Without the Eucharist, without the holy sacrifice of the Mass, which of course is making present Christ's suffering and death on the cross, there would be no salvation, there would be no church, there would be no, you know, there wouldn't be anything. So it all sorts, that's why it's the source. It's the very source. Everything about our faith is contained in the Mass. That brings to my mind the term, the old Irish saying that I've heard you use
it's
a lot
the Mass
of times.
That matters.
It's the Mass that matters, yes. And it is. It's what you might say, in a way, it's the only thing that matters. Because if there wasn't the Mass, then there would be no... there would be no Christianity. There would
salvation.
Be no, there would be no salvation.
Redemption.
Yes. So there'd be no faith without the Mass. The Vatican II document, let me refer to that. I've got something here. The Dogmatic Constitution of the Church, one of the 16 documents of Vatican Council II, sometimes better known as Lumen Gentium,
Light of the Gentile
yes,
world,
the light of the
nations.
It says, quote, taking part in the Eucharistic sacrifice, which is the font and apex, now that's the source and the summit, the font from what something comes, you know, and the apex, that's the height of, or the summit, of the whole Christian life, the participants offer the divine victim to God and offer themselves along with it. That finishes the aspect of it dealing with the source. That the Mass is the source
for Christian life,
the Christian
worship.
Yes, and then the summit aspect of it, let me read here what the Catechism says about the summit. The summit, we're talking about the height, or the apex, as they say in the Vatican Council's words. Quote, the Eucharist is the efficacious sign, that means effective, I guess, more as much as anything else, effective. The Eucharist is the efficacious sign and sublime cause of that communion in the divine life and that unity of the people of God by which the Church is kept in being. It is the culmination, both of God's action, sanctifying the world in Christ, and of the worship men offered to Christ and through him to the Father, in the Holy Spirit. In other words, it's the most sublime, it's the highest form that we can possibly offer to God, the greatest thing that we can offer God. In other words, when we unite our own suffering and sorrow and talent and treasure and this and that and the other to Christ's sacrifice, it's the most sublime, holy thing we can do. Nothing higher.
I remember Rosalind Moss, who is a marvelous convert from Judaism and who speaks at many conventions across the country, talked about when she first realized, because she knew all about the Old Testament, was raised an Orthodox, fine Jewish young woman, and she said, I first realized what the Mass really was, that she said I could, and how it was the fulfillment of everything that I've been taught all through my life, and that Jesus was the Messiah, and here was the fulfillment of the Old Testament, the Passover Lamb. She said, I can hardly express what took place in my mind. And it's one of those things that converts help us realize that go on, that sometimes we just sort of take for granted, and they're coming out of the desert and suddenly finding the oasis in the middle of the desert, and that at the Eucharist for her was the oasis.
Well, you know, I know you're familiar with Grodi.
Marcus Grodi.
Mm-hmm. He and Scott Hahn and probably another 400 or 500 men who in the last 10 years or so have converted from the Protestant ministries into the Catholic faith have been absolutely amazed. That was one of the things that more than anything else caught their attention, and how biblical the Catholic Church is, how the Mass from the very beginning is biblical. And
a fulfillment of
yes,
the Old Testament,
yes.
The Old Covenant.
Well, most of these Protestant churches are really into covenant theology in a big way, which is wonderful. And that's one of the things that I think these Protestants have brought into the Catholic Church, is this stress on covenant theology, which deals with the Old Covenant, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and how the Old Covenant is hidden in the New, and or how the New is hidden in the Old, and how the Old is fulfilled in the New. St. Augustine said something along that line. Augustine said something along that line.
It is marvelous. And I've certainly benefited from all the insights that these men like you mentioned, Marcus Grudai and Scott Hahn, have brought into the church.
Oh, yes.
And the emphasis on things that perhaps I just had never emphasized before.
Well, you know, St. Matthew was writing primarily for Jews. And the reason that there's so much stress in the Gospel of Matthew in regard to the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah was that he was trying to convince the Jews that Jesus was the fulfillment of these prophecies. And there are lots of different prophecies, such as, the suffering servant prophecies that you find in Isaiah 52 and 53, and in other places, in the Psalms and in Zechariah and other places. The idea of the conquering king, that idea is found in the Old Testament. You see a lot about the Blessed Mother, many prophecies in the Old Testament that make reference to the Blessed Mother.
Virgin shall conceive,
yes,
and bear a child.
In fact, I'm teaching a class right now to high school kids, juniors and seniors, where we've been looking at understanding the Bible, and we've just been through a rather... probably 50 different prophecies that you find in the Old Testament categorized different ways that foretell the coming of the Messiah.
I'd like to sit in on that class, Ron. It sounds very fascinating. I think we're coming towards the close of our program, and so why don't we just, we'll begin the next program with summarizing what we've said about the Mass, and then we can go into that famous chapter, sixth chapter, the Eucharistic chapter, that has been so powerful ever since John wrote it in the first century. So many thanks for your being with us, for keeping holy the Lord's Day, that the Lord's Day can keep us holy, whole, and wholesome. May God bless you always and in all ways.